Welcome to the Troubleshooters Podcast with me, your host, Mike McGrath. Now, today I've been joined by two great business troubleshooters. Peter Gordon and David Aston are the founders and owners of Design to Production, a digital communications and merchandising solutions provider. Basically, they design and manufacture clever signage and other cool stuff. Now, these guys have built a great business, and in spite of COVID, they're killing it. However, this wasn't always the case. They've had to dodge some bullets along the way, including a period where one customer was over 90% of total revenue. So sit back and enjoy their stories as they talk to us about how they came back from the brink. So Peter and David, welcome to the Troubleshooters Podcast.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for the nice intro.
It's a pleasure. Good to have you both here. I've been looking forward to this chat. Now, we do go back a little bit of a way. I think end of 17, I think we teamed up and we did a little bit of work together. Things were a bit different for you back then, weren't they? You know, you had some challenges around revenue concentration and the market was sliding a bit. So look, before we get into that, tell us a little bit about how you guys met and what got you into business together. You've been in business at Design to Production for how long?
Almost 11 years now. In fact, tiny bit over 11 years, I believe. Is that right, Dave?
Yeah, 11 years to the last month.
Yep. And so I was doing some contract design work and Dave was working with a company that I was contracting to. And we were sent away on a project together. And I think we was sitting at a bar one night thinking, you know, I think we can do this better ourselves. And we just started talking and, you know, one thing led to another. And before too long, we were building prototypes on a kitchen bench.
Wow.
At that moment, I think we realized that we could do it better.
Just so I'm clear, Peter, yeah. You, for the viewers, you were contracting at the time. So you're a designer.
That's right. I was a contract or industrial designer and I was freelancing to various kiosk manufacturers and design companies. Yeah. Working on similar projects to what we do now, although they're a little bit more advanced these days. But I was designing and 3D modeling, drafting and documenting, design detailing, how these products were to be manufactured and how they were to be built. And sort of at the same time talking to Dave, who was working with another company on building those products.
Right.
So, you know, Dave's expertise in the manufacturing side of it was invaluable for me when I was designing these products because we would always have conversations about, oh, how do you reckon this should be or what's an economical way to do this or what does your machinery allow us to do here? And so we were having pretty in-depth conversations about building a product and getting it to market as efficiently as possible.
So, David, tell us about your background. So what were you doing at that point?
So slightly before that time, I was in manufacturing. It's where I did my trade. I actually remember Pete first coming into the manufacturing place and placing an order for a few digital signs when he was, this was pre-DP. And I sort of, you know, met him a few times through there. And then a couple of years after that, I ended up getting poached from a company that does sort of touchscreen interactive stuff. That's when, we sort of got to spend a little bit more time with each other. And like what Pete was sort of suggesting, you know, my background was manufacturing, Pete's was design, and we were just, sort of, you know, gelling really well doing what we do for someone else. And, you know, the more time we sort of spent with each other, the more time we realized that, you know, the synergy was really good between us, not from a design and production point of view necessarily, but just general friendship and how we got on.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of what happened there. We sat down in a pub and had a few drinks and made the decision to consider doing something ourselves.
Great. Look, I think there's an important point here really around partnerships and teaming up. Because I remember back in 17 when I sort of met you guys and started working with you, I was quite excited because I felt you were a great team. And so, you know, I saw that, you know, Peter on the one hand was very good at sort of design. He was quite creative and he sort of had that kind of hell fellow well met. And then Dave, you were the production guy, like the nuts and bolts. How are we going to make it? How are we going to do it? So I think that's quite important. A lot of businesses I see where people partner up and they're sort of the same. The magic is in the differences in a way, you know, so the sum of the parts is less than the sum of the whole, really, if you can get the right partner.
I think it would have been a lot more challenging if we both enjoyed the same tasks at work, you know, like if we were both competing over the same tasked to draw the sketch of what it's going to look like, or if we're both saying, oh, no, I think it should be made this way, or, you know, I think there's a better way to do it. You know, we had trust in each other to sense that, well, if Dave thinks that this is the best way to make it, I'm not going to argue, you know. I'm going to back it 100%.
Yes.
And vice versa.
Yeah. And so you decide to start the business. Who came up with the name Design to Production?
Dave.
Yeah, no, look, we both did. And we did spend a lot of time on the kitchen bench with, you know, prototyping and going backward and forward before we got our first office. And yeah, we came up with some cool sketches and we were sort of saying, what are we about? What are we about? And Dave and Pete is the two initials that sort of needed to represent something. And so we sort of, you know, formed that into...
is that right? I never thought of that. Dave and Pete.
Design to Production. And so we sort of said, you know, it's going to be a little bit of a play on words with the DP. And that's what we rolled with. And then when everyone sort of meets us, they do sort of give us credit and take some more. Oh, Dave and Pete, is that?
So look, before we get into the story of Design to Production, because it's a great story and you've built a fantastic business, let's go back a little bit further. So was there anything in your background that suggested you were going to end up running your own business, building a company, being entrepreneurs? You know, were you always those kinds of people, Pete?
I never saw myself as owning a business, to be honest. Both of my parents are school teachers. My father teaches industrial arts,
right.
You know, material science and manufacturing technologies and things like that. And so that was kind of always had a passion for that. My mother was quite artistic as well. She used to paint and do drawings. And weekends she'd send me off to do drawing classes in the park and things like that. And so I was always quite creative. But in terms of owning my own business, I remember when I first started working for myself, my parents were just so nervous thinking, you know, we have nothing to be able to offer you in knowledge of how to run a business because, you know, they were very hardworking and they had some very good work ethics, but they really didn't have any experience in running a business. So I never saw myself to do that, to be honest. And for many years after I finished university, I studied industrial design. I was making furniture, but it was a bit of a labor of love and only making and designing things for friends. So very wrong approach to the way a business should be set out, I guess.
David, you ever done metalwork at school or anything like that?
I did. I didn't take too much of a liking into it.
No.
I mean, I don't know. I sit there and I think about it and I go, you know, why did mum choose that or why did mum choose that? And I remember I did a little bit of experience in the kitchen and then she sort of just went into one thing to the other and guided me around. And I was a bit of a brat, you know, in my younger days. And when I sort of found myself at this place, I didn't put, you know, when I say I was a bit of a brat, that's probably me talking very nicely. But I just thought that this was the opportunity to really make up for all my school years and really, really put some serious effort in.
I was going to say, you knuckled down, you took to it, you did your apprenticeship. You're obviously learning a lot, right, about how stuff got done, really.
Absolutely. And the guys there, you know, big credit to my past and my future, they were allowing me to do things that they hadn't done before. So dealing with big companies like Electrolux and just managing like a new barbecue or Maytag and managing a new rollout where we'd be importing fridges in, reskinning them locally. And this place was huge, right? And they were not normally picking up these deals and giving me free rein. And I was 20.
Wow.
This is, you know, 2007. And I was on about 100K, which was a lot. It's a lot now. It's a lot back then.
Yes.
And I was inspired to go to work, you know, and tell my story, you know, come home and tell my dad. You know, I like dealt with Maytag, dealt with Electrolux, dealt with these guys sitting in the room with project managers and, you know, it was just really, really driving me.
So, Dave, fair play that they gave you some responsibility really, didn't they? They must have seen something in you that said, look, you know, look, we'll let this guy off the chain a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And, again, a big credit to where I'm at is those guys and giving me the opportunity. And I remember my boss said to me at the time, he sort of says, you probably want my job. And I said, no, I don't think I do because I don't think there's enough there for me. You know, and we laughed about it and I still laugh about it. And he goes, you're going to have your own business. And he goes, I know you're going to have your own business and it's going to be really successful. And I said, oh, yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
And I'm not sort of blowing any smoke up. But as we've gone along that whole journey, those guys have supported us massively.
Yeah.
They were, in fact, one of our first jobs, weren't they, Dave? When we first working together, it was FJ Precision, the sheet metal company, and one of the big first projects we did was designing and documenting the Westpac ATM surrounds.
Absolutely.
There was literally a new design every week, and they would be manufacturing them a day or two after we finished the drawings, and you know, a week later they were being installed across Australia.
That was actually our first job in DP.
That's right.
Before we even had our office, you know. And again, they gave us another opportunity, as knowing that we were just starting out in business. I guess there's a story there. Definitely don't ever burn your bridges.
Yes.
But they got us back, and they knew Pete because Pete, you know, used to, like I said before, buy enclosures off us that we used to manufacture and sell them in the digital space. And then so they knew us, and they couldn't have done that project without us. And, to get introduced to something of that scale was massive for our first bit of credibility for the business as well. But, yeah, it was really big. So
you team up, you meet up, you have a drink in a pub, and you say, right, let's get going. You pull on your old firm, FJ Precision, and you get some work. So when was the first time you thought, Dave, okay, I want to get into business? I mean, what was it? Because you clearly had something going on.
Look, I guess it was probably Pete. So, you know, Pete's a little bit older than me and a little bit more experienced. So when I was still working, you know, at FJ's or the other mob, Pete sort of did say to me, and I remember and I never forget it, but he did say to me, he says, mate, I know it's going to be hard for you because you're probably thinking working for yourself, you know, no stability, and it's just you're taking that risk, you know. And he goes, I completely understand it. I know it'll be hard. But Pete, the nice guy that he is, you know, he sort of say, mate, I can tell you it's okay. I've got, you know, some contacts. I really believe that we can make this work.
Yes.
And so I had a chat to my dad, and dad's like, mate, just do it. And he backed me a little bit financially and just sort of said, right, for the next couple of months, don't worry about the money in your bank for rent and things like that.
Yes.
You just go out there and do what you do best and do it with Pete. And I took that leap with all my sort of knowledge and understanding of where I wanted to do, but he kind of pushed me over the edge. And then we kicked things off and never looked back, I guess. It's one of those things, once you make that leap and you're flying solo,
yes,
you can't really look back, and you don't really want to look down. You just want to put your blinkers on and keep looking ahead.
You said an interesting thing earlier. You said that you wanted to do things better, or you thought you could do things better. What did that mean for you at that point?
Yeah, I think we identified that the guys that we were working for and with at the time seemed like they were wasting time and energy, wasting money. You know, I think we just understood what the client wanted, and we figured out the best and quickest way to do it for them.
Yes.
And less sort of mucking around, you know, less money on overheads. I mean, we were lucky to have a clean slate in a way, because we didn't have to have all the equipment and all the machinery. You know, we just literally had a laptop and a couple of telephones. And at that time, that's all we needed, because we would get different companies to manufacture different parts for us, and all we needed was a little bit of space to do some assembly work. And sometimes we would do that assembly work with the companies who were doing the manufacturing for us. You know, we'd borrow a bit of space in their back shed, in their back workshop, and, you know, pay them for it. But at the same time, we didn't have to have a huge amount of tools and equipment and, you know, all the gear. And we would only purchase something if we really needed it, you know, like if we needed to set up a workbench, for instance, or if we needed to set up a an assembly area, and, you know, we'd roll up bubble wrap. We didn't have an account with a packaging company. We didn't have to have accounts with freight companies. You know, all those things, they take time to set up, but they also cost money. And, and I guess that was one of the next lessons, was cash flow. And Dave's very good at that. And I remember one of the early challenges we had is the faster we grew, the bigger the projects were, the bigger the cash flow we'd need, you know. So it was finding that line. Once upon a time, we'd look at a job and it was like a $3,000 job. And we go, well, okay, well, we need to pay those guys and pay those guys, but we can't pay them until we get paid. And then at the same time, we'd be taking on a job for $100,000. And all of a sudden, we've got to owe 30 grand to these guys. And we've only got the last job that was worth 5 grand to pay them with it. So it was a real balancing act. And Dave's dad gave us some great advice and helped us a lot at those early stages. Not so much financially, but more just, look, this is how you guys got to do it. This is how you got to set yourselves up. This is how we do it. You know, it was pretty fast learning curve for that type of work, because every couple of months go by, the projects just got bigger and bigger.
So let's just put some context around this. So you start collecting some clients, you start making stuff, you know, you're finding your way to put things together, you're being efficient, and then you snag yourself a big client at some point in this cycle that turns you into a multi-million dollar business, effectively.
Yep.
You know, quite quickly.
Yep.
So that whole outdoor advertising space kind of blew up, didn't
it? Right.
And there was a big demand for digital signage. Just walk us through that kind of expansion, really, that explosion that happened to you.
I think Dave mentioned before, one of the first projects that I was working on was a digital signage. In fact, I think we were one of the first to do a small format digital sign in Australia. And that's, you know, the signs you see when you go to the shopping centre, or the signs, the digital signs you see when you go to the airports, or you see them on the side of the roads now, you know, in bus shelters, etc. So we had a client, and I'd been working with them for a couple of years in their early stages. And as they grew, because we were, you know, we had a great working relationship with these guys, and we still do. And we were designing, and we were innovating, and we were manufacturing, and we were assembling them, and it was going pretty well, and it still does. So
yeah,
we were at the mercy of them.
Yes.
Because after 5 years of, or more, it's like 8 years, I guess, of supplying them, they were going gangbusters. They were just getting bigger and bigger themselves. And there were some little sideline sort of businesses that we would do work for as well in a similar space, you know, smaller out-of-home companies. We got a really good reputation of being able to deliver and innovate. Some of the reasons why we were getting so much work is that we were not just necessarily following the brief, but coming back to them with ideas of how we could make it better, and, you know, coming up with packaging solutions for them, coming up with installation solutions, ways to make the logistics of that particular sign more efficient.
Yes.
And, like I said, we had some great contacts in that business and or that industry as well, and so that just led the growth.
So you were very responsive. You were very focused. I mean, this is quite a common story insofar as, you know, you don't get to choose a concentration issue. It finds you, effectively. You know, there's an opportunity. A client's growing. You're Johnny on the spot. You've been very good to them. They're giving you all the work. And then all of a sudden, you've got a multi-million dollar business now. We're talking about more than $5 million. And 90% of it's with one customer. That was the kind of story, wasn't it, really? And everything was going great insofar as they were paying well,
were
able to cash flow the business. But
I think that's about the time we met you.
Yeah.
And then I think you're pretty quick to identify. You said, guys, you know, you need someone on the outside looking in to give you some guidance. And I'm so grateful that we did that at the time because, you know, I remember you saying, you know, you're one phone call away from extinction. And that sort of rung true. You look around and you go, shit, imagine, you know, if those guys rang up and said, sorry, guys, we found someone else, or thanks, but no thanks, or, you know.
Well, it's interesting, Dave. I mean, you talk about that. That's not an issue when everything's going great. And the point is, you can't solve a concentration issue quickly or easily. Like, I mean, you've got to almost put a cotton wool around that client and treat them really well whilst figuring out a plan to perhaps do something else to diversify over time. So tell us a bit about what you did there, because you guys did some great work around diversification. Now, I know it was thrust on you a bit because, you know, that client, through no fault of yours, began to just buy less off you, didn't it? Because it didn't have the need
That's
it previously had. That was a challenge.
Dave,
right?
Dave was pretty good. I mean, you can expand on this, Dave, but you're pretty good to identify how we go about that, because when they stop ordering and we've still got 20 staff and we've got massive factory space and massive office space, you know, a couple of quiet months and you're going backwards pretty quick. And I think Dave was quick to react to that and identify that we needed to have a more flexible work staff to expand and contract as required.
Yes.
That was the big challenge, I guess, and that was the thing. So, you know, coming into the large growth is what you're talking about. It's a little bit easier to grow and you don't think about having to contract until you obviously need to. And so that was the obvious challenge, but yeah, just obviously keeping a close eye on the finances and what they're doing, you know, quite far ahead. I remember at that time, my old man was giving us advice on the accounting side of things, and he was, you know, showing me to look into the future, your regular cash flow reports and your things like that. Mm. And when everything looks okay, you know, it's easy to sort of manage, but when you start to sort of see it get a little bit lumpy, that's when you sort of have to really buckle down and like what Pete expressed, you know, starting to contract and be able to be in a position that you can expand again.
Because one of the ways out of that is to diversify, but that takes a while. Yeah. You know, you can't just turn that tap on immediately. You need to you know, get out there and start looking for it. And I think, Mike, you helped us identify other industries that we could be looking into and other markets, and that was when we started to look at international markets.
Yeah. Look, I was a classic textbook, right? So you've got, you know, 90%+ of revenue with one client. That client is demanding a certain level of loyalty, which limits your ability to go into their market
Yes.
and supply their competitor. The Australian market's not that big. And then you start looking, okay, well, what are you guys good at? And you are extremely good at manufacturing. You're extremely good at design. I mean, that's one of the reasons those guys were using you, is that you were coming up with very contemporary looking design that was leading the, you know, leading the industry.
Yep.
And so, you know, could you switch that? And I know we looked at the US, and we felt the US market was certainly large enough to dip your toe in. But you guys executed that beautifully. You guys just got on a plane.
We had a bit of an advantage in the sense that Australia is one of the leading markets for digital out of home, especially the small format. Even now, like you go to the States or you go to Europe, they don't have as much small format digital advertising as we do here. And especially back then, like even 5 years ago, they were, I mean, I know they do now, but they were using less facial recognition than what we do, programmatic advertising. Their signage was less sophisticated. And I don't know why that was. I mean, because they're quite advanced economies and technology
in other areas
but it just didn't seem like they were quite there. And so when we went to a couple of international trade shows and had some products on exhibition there, so like we went to the digital signage show in Las Vegas, that was a good one for us, and the other one was the ISE, which was in Amsterdam, and these are, well, the ISE is one of the largest possibly in the world for that type of products. We had some products there, and I think that's where people sort of took notice of what we could do. We had some cutting-edge designs there that people couldn't really believe that we could make something so thin, and the build quality was second to none. And it was at those shows that we were introduced to a couple of potential clients, and that's led to, you know, the last 3 years working with companies like Mars Wrigley's, and that's been a great project for us.
And, I mean, that's a great story, isn't it, that, you know, you were able to compete globally.
Yeah.
Talk about that, what you've been able to do there, because I think it's such a great story.
When we first went to, it was a trade show called CinemaCon, and it was basically at the Bellagio Casino. They have some of the big conference centers there. And
unfortunately.
Yeah. It could have been a worse place to be. There was products there, for everything to do with cinemas. So they've got ticketing machines, they've got popcorn machines, they've got candy vending machines, and so one of our friends said, come over and check out this machine, you know, it was a Skittles vending machine, and they go, you guys should be able to do one of those, and we sort of, yeah, of course, mate, can we have a look inside? We took some photos, and we were in the States for a couple of weeks at that time, and so we thought, well, let's just get on the front foot here, and we were traveling with one of our senior designers as well. We all sort of sat down together and drew some shapes and said, well, imagine if we could make it look like this. And we spent a bit of time on it. And within a couple of weeks, I think it was less than probably about a week, we'd actually done some 3D modeling and we'd done some renders of what it could look like. And we sent that straight back to the guys. And they couldn't believe that we could turn something around so quick. And, and that we were, well, firstly, that we're Australian and in America, even talking to them, like half of them hadn't even, I probably didn't even know where Australia was. But I think it was that sort of efficiency or the speed that we had done that sort of work for them without asking for anything, you know, like, here, okay, what about this concept, or what about this, or what if it could be like that? And so that got pushed down the road a little bit further, and we were asked then to provide some pricing and go a little bit further down the track. And that probably took 2 or 3 months. And then by that time, we're back in Australia, and sort of went dead then for a while. And we sort of followed it up a little bit later and said, oh, what's going on? They said, look, you know what? It's just a little bit too hard. You know, you guys down in Australia, it's too hard for us to vet you guys. And, you know, I just don't think it's going to work. Thanks. Great ideas, but I just don't think it's going to work.
Classic.
Yep. And then 6 months later, or maybe a little bit more, maybe 7 months, the phone rings and it's like, oh, you guys still interested? And apparently they tried to get some American companies to do it. I think they even spoke to a European company. And they just didn't have the, I don't know, the spunk that we were showing in the sense that, you know, we were, we were proposing facial recognition and gesture control and a few cool things like that.
Yes.
And these other companies hadn't even heard of that. Or, I mean, the trouble was they were talking to an old school vending company, or they were talking to an old school sheet metal manufacturer. They weren't really thinking about it as a smart kiosk. They were just coming at it from the same old approach as the vending industry's been doing for 20, 30 years.
Yes.
You know, we had to sharpen the pencil and we had to come up with better ways, and we had to do a lot more work on it. That's when we got the go-ahead, basically. They said, all right, well, if you guys can produce these at X price and you can add these features into it, you're on. And so we literally just got back from presenting the prototypes about a month ago now, about a 95% chance we're going into production before the end of the year.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And I mean, to put this in context, this is a multi-million dollar order.
That's right.
With, you know, likes of Wrigley that's going to run for several years.
Yeah, they've got a schedule to roll out 3,000 over the next couple of years. And I mean, for Australian company, that's massive.
Yes,
we just don't have the scale here of that. No. I mean, like, just say there was going to be a Skittles machine in every, the most you could hope for might be a couple of hundred. And, you know, and then that would be it. You'd be capped. But I guess that's why these other markets for us are now so important. And not to forget the Australian markets, of course, and we will always work for Australian markets. But it just opens a lot more doors. And, I mean, they're already talking about M&Ms and other products.
So, Dave, just putting this into context for me. So 4 years ago, you're a $5 million business. You've got 90% concentration. Quite quickly, that unravels a bit. You know, you're down to a couple of million very quickly. You were a big part, as Pete said earlier, of reorganizing that business of yours. And now, 4 years later, you're diversified. Nobody's more than, I don't know, 10 or 15%. Is that right?
Yeah, we've got everyone down on a pretty sort of equal playing ground, I guess, so to speak. But yeah, look, mate, definitely has its challenges, as you know. And looking at the numbers, I think, you know, you also reinforce this, I guess, with your understanding of business and knowledge, which is it's the accounting side of things that, you know, you really need to spend a lot of time in looking at and focusing on. And I've just, you know, enjoy doing it, sitting down with our accounts and just keeping a close eye on where things are at in the future and what's to come. Putting it all together with your income, with your sales, taking the advice of obviously people like yourself of diversifying, and then, you know, really putting money back into not only how we diversify our income, but how do we diversify our technology and how do we diversify what we're building, you know? And if this industry is flooded, then what other industry can we move into? They're the big things that we've done really well. And one of the things that when Pete was talking about the Mars stuff is the technology that they really saw that we were good at, you know. We are probably the best in design, and we're looked upon as like a European sort of, you know, design Ferrari Lamborghini sort of style of electronics and digital technology.
Yes.
But with the software, that's what we're able to do really well. And so having your one-stop shop, I guess, so to speak, just to supply the whole thing turnkey, there's a lot of merits there, I guess, for big clients looking at, you know, companies just to one solution, one phone call. They don't want to necessarily know too much about the detail, but they want to leave it up to one person because obviously in the industry it's quite common that, you know, everyone tries to dissect certain things and everyone starts to sort of not really synergize too well. So it's been a pretty interesting last couple of years.
Yes. But, I mean, it's interesting that the way you see yourselves now as a digital communications and merchandising business, that you've just got a broader self-concept, haven't you, of what it is that you can do? Because, you know, you've moved into confectionery. You're not just the cool sign guys anymore.
No, definitely. I think the things that put us on the map in terms of Mars Wrigley's and those sorts of clients is the ability to have the gesture control, gamification. And we dipped our toe in the water with that futuristic fund that's like a kids games console that currently that we've got a few into shopping centres. And, for instance, we've found that when COVID hit, we had a touchscreen on there and a payment device and you had to enter your details for a photograph via the touchscreen. During COVID, we thought, well, we've got in-house software. Let's develop some gesture control so you don't even have to touch the unit anymore. And the ability to have that software in-house and being able to pivot like that, I guess, helps keep the wheels turning.
Yes.
And it's so timely because that's as soon as we developed that, we thought, well, perfect application would be in a vending machine as well. You know, I mean, even though you have to touch the machine to take the cup of product out, the less touches, the better.
Yes.
And plus it makes it fun. And you see someone standing in front of a digital enclosure and they're waving their arms around and they're laughing and they're mucking around with their friends. Of course, other people are going to be attracted to that. And they're going to come over and go, oh, give me a go at that. And I think that's the types of innovation that design to production is good at and that I think international companies are looking for right now.
Yeah. What's the future for design to production? I mean, you guys obviously love what you do. You've definitely found a niche here, haven't you, both of you? You complement each other. So what's the future? Do you see more growth, expansion? Do you see more overseas? Where are you going?
I think definitely more international work, for sure. I think where in the past we would be designing an enclosure and then handing it on to our clients to install them and maintain them and monitor them, we're moving into more of a full turnkey solution where we can offer everything So
right.
not just the enclosure, but the actual hardware that goes within the enclosure, the installation services, the monitoring services. That's really important, especially for companies that have large networks. They just want to know that it's all being looked after.
Yes.
One of the things that we're seeing right now and that we're working on is the electric vehicle charging stations.
Okay.
That's a pretty hot topic at the moment.
Yes. Yeah, sure.
It's going to happen. At the moment, there's companies trying to roll these out with the help of media revenue.
Yeah. Okay.
So rather than just putting a charging station in a shopping center, the model is that you can put one up front, you know, in a good parking spot. And so if you've got a good parking spot, obviously the media dollars are going to be there as well because people want to advertise in the most visible, prominent sites.
Yes.
We're working on a bit of that at the moment.
And how's COVID affected you guys? I know that you've done some pretty cool work, Dave, on the back end to make sure you can fluctuate with, you know, rising and falling demand, right? Which I think is smart. But how have you managed with COVID? You talk about overseas. How's that going to be affected, you think, in this sort of post-COVID era?
Yeah, look, it certainly affected us, you know, late last year and early last year probably the most. I think the whole world stood still.
I know.
What we're sort of seeing, you know, obviously a lot of our work is in the retail space where I think shopping centres and that whole retail space are actually getting hungrier, I guess, for our kind of products.
Right.
They've got that ongoing fight with online, right? And so that's a thing and that's happening. And so how do they fight back, you know? And they fight back by, you know, making those shopping centres better environments. Yeah. They want, you know, more interaction. You can see that by what they're doing. Other means of revenue coming out of self-service, digital, cool things, which is basically our space. So what we've been really good at and what we've been actively doing is, you know, not necessarily waiting for clients to come to us for a product. We've been jumping on the front foot.
Right.
We've got software, we've got platforms, we've got design, we've got prototyping, we've got high volume manufacturing, we've got overseas capacity. So right now is probably the most exciting time for us because we're basically putting everything together and no one really has to think. You know, some of the products that we've come and developed, especially these last couple of years, like what Pete lent on, they're COVID safe. You know, we're actually on the front foot with, you know, saying, right, well, you can touch the screen, but you don't actually have to touch it. You can have this in your shopping center and this can bring kids in to want to be able to play this game. And
increase
and so
the dwell time.
Increase the dwell time and things like that. And so we're sort of following that trend. And that's what's been good, you know. And that only comes with experience. It only comes with trust from not only, obviously, your business partner, your clients, and also your employees. It's a massive thing, you know. Everyone sort of sticking together and putting their faith in each other and trust and just moving forward. And you know, a big credit to the whole team. We've just been able to really execute well and off the back of having, you know, clients that are always willing to back us as well. So,
well, look, I mean, it's a huge shout out to you guys because, you know, if I was able to help a little bit back in 17, great. But Steve Jobs said that a great idea or a strategy is worthless without top class execution. And I think the fact that you're here now, that you executed on some of that strategy, you know, I mean, Pete, you were in the US last week or the week before, weren't you?
Yeah, well, I was 2 weeks in quarantine.
I don't know anyone that's been to the US in the last month, let me tell you.
They were actually chasing him out of the airport, the people at the checkout, sort of saying, can you just tell me how you got back to Australia? Because I've got family that have been trying for 3 months and you just walked in for 2 weeks and then jumped on an aeroplane out of here. They thought
It was a bit scary getting off at LA and there was literally only 25 people on the plane over there and you get off the plane and the airport was packed. It was people everywhere and no one wearing masks. It was like, oh my God.
Yeah. That airline industry in the US has just carried on. I mean, right the way through COVID, they kept flying.
Yeah. Well, there's three flights leaving Sydney every day to LA.
Is that right?
Yeah, three different airlines are flying from Sydney to LA daily.
Wow. Wow.
The planes are empty and the return flights are empty as well. I don't understand it, but anyway.
Yeah. Our chats about COVID, we've certainly dated this podcast, so we're all stuck in Sydney.
Yeah.
Quite a severe lockdown, right? But, you know, the vaccine rates are on the rise, which is good. And I saw the UK are opening up quite nicely at the moment. I think they're 75% vaccinated. So
just a sort of one thing, Mike, I think we just didn't mention there was the effects of the COVID with freight costs and international shipping. And
yes.
We felt the effects of that a little bit.
Yes, no doubt.
And, you know, it's just so hard to get anything these days. And
Yeah. Look, as you know, I'm on the board of quite a few companies. Five of the manufacturers, we're all doing pretty well. All our problems are on the supply side, not the demand side. The demand's strong.
Yeah.
Mining's going well. You know, on the board of a lighting company, we're flying. Yep. But all supply side issues, And I think that's going to get worse. I mean, we're not predicting any kind of normality till next April or May on some of our supply. I'm involved with a company called Harness Master, and we're really struggling to get copper and some of the raw material stuff into our factory in the Philippines.
That's the big thing in the shipping industry, right? It's just, you know, less boats, less airplanes, high demand. Everyone's trying to get back to business and feeling the effects of, you know, companies contracting and not being able to expand fast enough, or whether they do or not. And so the demand's just going absolutely through the roof, hence why, you know, 12 months offers a 1,000% increase on containers. Yes.
Yeah. But look, you know, the good news is that I'm speaking to lots of companies in the course of my work, which is always an interesting, a bit of a joy, really. And I'm amazed how many companies like you have been able to navigate COVID and done well. I mean, there's definitely some losers, anyone in the airline or anyone, you know, in hospitality. But overall, I'm amazed how we've been able to kind of manage really so far.
It's incredible.
It's been remarkable, I think.
I agree.
Well, look, thanks so much for coming on, guys, and being so honest and vulnerable and talking a bit about your story. I've no doubt you two guys are going to go from strength to strength, and that design to production is going to be around for a long time. And if anyone wants some cool signage, other cool stuff, right?
The plug.
Where do they need to get hold of you?
Design to production.
www.d-p.com.au.
Yeah, great. Okay.
Check out our YouTube channel.
You will be inundated now. You have no idea how many people who want signage you listen to this podcast. So look, thanks again and stay safe, fellas.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. You too.
So I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Troubleshooters Podcast. I think Dave and Pete are a great team and complement each other's different skill sets very well. They also have what it takes to stare down the proverbial barrel and make the tough calls when they have to. Now, if you like this content, be sure to subscribe and tell your friends. Big shout out to our sponsors, Oasis Partners, for great corporate advice with a practical bias. Call the guys at Oasis. And finally, if you want to talk to Peter and David about their business design to production, then their contact details will be in the show notes. So until next time, stay safe.